right? O-N?
That's
I always
it.
Get that confused. Dawn, right? Good. How are you guys? I mean, we're off to a smooth start. How are you guys doing? The ushers are gonna, that was patronizing, thanks. The ushers are gonna come forward. There's a lot of ways to partner with this community. Financially is one of those. So if you came prepared to partner financially with what God is doing in and through this community, that would be what the bag with the handles is about as that goes by. I'm gonna pull a MacGyver and turn this chair into a table. What do you think? Does that work? All right, let's do that. All right, so yeah, we're going to dive into week two of the series that we just started last week entitled Dexter. Decisions, excuse me. And so we changed the image a little bit. Don Smith, he makes our, he does all this really cool stuff up here. And last week, he ran it through this this visual filter that made rust really, really red. And so that's obviously been tweaked a little bit. It's very clearly rust. But last week, people were really like, I'm very uncomfortable. We're talking about decisions, and we're going to lead you to stab people, was really. But what was the only thing more fun than that? Nice.
Wow, pulling out all the surprises that's for right. Third service.
Yeah. Is that better?
Oh, wow. Good work.
A lot of the staff prays on Sunday morning. Don's in his office. No, that's great. All right. Yeah, the only thing better than people trying to deal with the apparent murder weapon that they thought they were looking at was people who just trust us and think, okay, well, they're making some of the side door kind of point. Is what they're doing. So I'm not going to get disgusted. I'm going to wait for them to tell me that it's good. And no, it was a bloody pair of scissors. Sorry. So now clearly you can see that it's rust, and that's what that was about. We're in this series entitled Decisions because the word decision is really two words combined. D means off, and scission means cut. And so an off cut or a cut off, that is the thrust of how we make a decision. You have an issue and you consider all of the things around it and you cut the parts off that you've predetermined aren't beneficial. You cut off the things that you don't need in order to get down to the thing that you're deciding to live with. What's the remnant I want to live with? That's what a decision is. Small or great, we're always making decisions, and you have to have some way of cutting off the parts that don't benefit you, that you don't need or find useful. When I was a kid, I grew up on a lake. And so before I drove a car, I drove a boat. We'd drive boats to each other's houses, about a 2-mile-long lake up in Ohio. And so I'm finding out this morning and telling this story. It's not as cool as I thought it was my whole life to have a boat with a big booming car stereo in it. Everybody just kind of looks at me like, you dork. Well, it's my childhood, so I forgive you for judging me. But this is what we did, you know, so taking boats to each other's houses, this big lake and this whole culture that we lived in with all these houses all the way around this lake and with a lake for your front yard. And so I didn't live right on it. I was a couple hundred yards away from it, but would walk down. I had spent my whole life down there. Well, in the winter, they would drain the lake down 7 or 8 feet so that the water wouldn't freeze around people's docks. And so it wouldn't break off the posts or wear them out. So you drop the water down below the dock level, but leave enough water in there not to kill the fish. And so there was this big, on my side, there was a dam and a spillway, this gigantic cement 45-degree angle spillway with a big tube, a 5-foot in diameter metal tube that came out. And so every fall, you turn the big donkey wheel and this water just flies out and they drain the whole lake and it goes down into a retention pool at the bottom of the spillway, down at a secondary pipe, and then, you know, 15 miles away down to another really big lake. So every fall, they open this thing up, and it's thousands of gallons a second. It's an entire swimming pool in the time it takes to say swimming pool. It's just tons of water flying out of this thing. So as you can imagine, as kids, there was a rule about the spillway, and the rule was, don't go near it. When they open up the spillway, don't go near it. Don't look directly at it. Don't say spillway. Stay away from it. And that was the rule. Every year, though, as we got older, we would get a little bit closer to the spillway in the fall and a little bit closer to the spillway until the point where we would go down and it's roaring water down this thing and it fills up the pool and we would be standing there watching it and I had hair back then, it'd blow your hair as it's going by, stick your hand in it, it would knock your hand really hard to the side. Every year get a little closer, so close you can't even hear each other talk over top of the roar. And then one year getting up on top of the pipe and looking down and as the water's rushing out, it's hitting you in the forehead. It's like, wow, man, we're really pushing the envelope. And then came the year. I was 13, 14 years old. And this roar, you could hear this roar. But over top of the roar that one particular day, I heard yelling. It was the yell of my brother, Jimmy. But it wasn't the please God save me yell. It was the I can't believe how awesome this is yell. And I run up to the edge of the spillway, and he and his friend are jumping off the top of the tube into this water, rushing down the 45-degree angle cement slope of death into the retention pond, and they're tumbling. They come out with moss and dirt and mud all over them and a big smile, and I'm watching him, and I yell, Jimmy, what are you doing? And he's smiling back at me, and I went from total shock to participation. Because I had a realization, this is a deep, deep insight for a 13-year-old. You're not dead. And so we spent the rest of that day playing in this water with the realization that we had wasted so much time. My entire childhood, I had grown up next to a free water park and had never participated. And so we're going down this thing over and over and over. And when you're little, you know, the things don't hurt as bad, but, you know, we're skinning elbows and knees and stuff. But we're going through this thing. But I had this realization. I'm suddenly struck with this. Again, I'm 13, 14 years old. I'm thinking, well, I wonder what else Mom and Dad exaggerated about. Because I'm clearly not dead. I wonder what other meaningless, arbitrary rules are in place simply to have rules in place. What else am I missing out on? Many of us are here today. We're faithful people. Maybe you're far from faith, somewhere in between, wherever you are. And we have been told or have come to learn that God is the cosmic enforcer of arbitrary rules. Some of them are common sense. Some of them are so weird that you laugh when you hear them. But God is this cosmic mom or cosmic dad that just makes rules. And because he made them, that defines what right and wrong is. Is this really, really wrong? I mean, what difference? Yes, it is wrong. Why? Because he said it's wrong. But does that make sense? Yes, he controls lightning. He gets to decide. Okay, but it doesn't make any... And many of us, we are being told that faith is about embracing and adopting rules, whether you like them or not, because everything is yes or no. It's okay, it's not okay. And many of us have come to realize in our adult life, I think I'm gonna play in the spillway. Now here's the funny thing is, now I'm 35 years old and I've got the three best children on the planet, and guess where they're not allowed to go? Ever. Now, as a 13 or 14-year-old, I made a very clear decision that day. This isn't a bad thing. Why was this bad? It's good. I made a very clear-headed, for a 13 or 14-year-old, I made a clear-headed decision. I'm going to do this. Now, over half my life later, no. If I were to move back into Ohio, into that town, one of the first things I'd do is call the community leader and say, will you put a cage around this tube so nobody can get near it? That's crazy. There's no reason we should have survived that. That's how I'm making decisions now. So the question is, do you have to cheat death to be able to make good decisions? Do you have to just barely escape a divorce, just barely get by bankruptcy, foreclosure, terminal illness, cancer? How do you become the kind of person that makes good decisions? And what does it mean from God's perspective for me to make decisions the right way?
Yeah, and so last week, you know, we kicked off this series and said, what would happen if we looked at all the different decisions that we make in day-to-day life, and we put some additional questions on top of those, use those as filters to help us make the best decisions possible. And so last week, we introduced this first question about what voice am I listening to? And trying to determine that when we're about to make a decision or thinking about a certain choice or certain decision, what voice am I listening to? Am I listening to this voice of impulse? Am I listening to this voice of survival that sometimes can get very loud and can dominate our thought process? Or am I trying to tune in to what's my Father's voice, my Heavenly Father's? What's God's voice? What's he trying to speak to me? Because his heart is for me and his desire is to lead me into life. And so how do I tune back in to that voice? And so that was the question we posed last week. And so today we want to introduce a second question that we think is critically important. And that I think the scriptures point to is critically important to ask whenever we're wrestling through a decision. Because all of us have this tendency to make decisions that are full of regret, that can be really, really dumb. I mean, we've all experienced that, looking back on certain decisions and like, why in the world did I do that? Why in the world did I make that choice? We could pass the microphone around, you know, and everybody in here has a story. You know, a story of, our man, yeah, here's when I really, you know, did something stupid. Here's when I really, you know, did something dumb and all full of regret. And we all do that.
I say we do that.
Okay.
Pass the microphone.
That'd be much more inspiring than, like, hopeful testimonies, you know? It's just like, tell us how dumb you were.
Pass the microphone around, see who the stupidest person in the room is. You win. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. That's you guys right. In next week?
All right. Get the dunce cap award. You can sit on stage in the corner. That'd be awesome.
I'll shut up now.
All right.
That's fourth service.
There you go. But, third service, you all always get the loosest part, man. The wheels mm-hmm. come off in third
I'm going to walk off any moment. I'm tired.
Gonna be snoring in the middle of something here in a minute. So what I want to do is explore why we find ourselves making decisions so many times that we end up regretting. Because we want to introduce this question to you, but before we get there, I think it's important that we understand how we get to so many decisions that lead to regret. In the Old Testament, there's a book called Jeremiah. If you have a Bible, you can turn there. It's in the Old Testament. If you flip open to the middle of your Bible, you'll kind of run into Psalms probably and then flip to the right. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 17. Jeremiah, he's a prophet in the Old Testament. And in the context of what Jeremiah is talking about here in chapter 17 is he's instructing the people, the Israelites, and saying, here, I want you to understand that the one who trusts in God, that people who choose to trust in God and to choose to trust God's heart for them, his desire is to lead you into life. And so he's painting these pictures and these metaphors of a tree planted by a stream who's getting, you know, all the roots filled with this, you know, fresh spring water, and this tree is growing. He's like, that's how your life is going to be if you choose to trust God, if you choose to let him lead you into life, that God wants to guide you into life. Will you trust him? But then he issues this warning. And this is the warning he gives in verse 9 of chapter 17. He says this. He said, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? The heart is deceitful above all things. Now, when faced with that reality, we recognize how humbling that is. Because each of us here in this room, you and I, we all carry the potential within us to have our hearts deceive us, to have our hearts manipulate us, where our hearts can very easily take a little bit of truth and take a little bit of untruth and mix it together and convince us of just about anything. And we know that that's true because you and I, we are experts at selling ourselves on something that we want to do. You might not think you're a good salesperson and all sorts of other things and other areas of your life, but when it comes to convincing ourselves or selling ourselves on something that we want to do, we're experts at that. I mean, we can talk ourselves into pretty much anything. We can take a very poor decision, a very bad decision, and we can come up with enough reasons to make it sound like it's a really great decision. You know, it's the best decision ever. We're very gifted at doing that. For example, maybe you've made a choice before to say, hey, I'm going to go on a diet for a while. So as part of this diet, you know, I'm going to cut out dessert. So, you know, you start that and you're like, okay, you're really committed to it. And then, you know, a few days later, you walk into your pantry and there's some, you know, Trader Joe's JoJo's, you know, peppermint JoJo's, way better than Oreos, you know. And you open it up and you're like, they are way better than Oreos. Have anyone had peppermint JoJo's? Yeah. See, amen. That's as good as an amen. So yeah, you know, you're
preach it, brother.
Bring
Sorry
it
to interrupt.
So, but yeah, you know, you're 2 or 3 days in and you're looking at those things and you're like, oh yeah, you know, it's been 2 or 3 days without dessert. Yeah, I deserve dessert. You know, that's a good thing. Or maybe you're at a restaurant and you're like, oh, I don't want dessert. I'm on a diet. I don't have a dessert. But then they bring out the dessert menu and you're like, man, I've got a gift card.
you know? And I'm not even paying for this. And if I don't use the gift card and all the money on the gift card, I'm not really sure if they're giving me back change or if they're gonna, you know, give me some extra gift card. And so we've got to spend it. I mean, it would be foolish to leave money on the gift card. So what else are you gonna do besides get dessert? And, you know, or you've done this where you've been maybe at a life group party or you've been at, you know, a friend's house or an office party and someone brings out this huge cake and you're like, oh, I'm on a diet. But what do you say to yourself? You say this, because I say this too, you know? And I'd really hurt their feelings if I didn't eat some of that cake. This is really for them, you know? I'm gonna take one for the team because I really care about them. And, you know, and again, this isn't to say that dessert is wrong. Dessert's not wrong. And, you know, enjoying food and finding joy and pleasure in eating, I mean, that's all that's good stuff. It's just, we lie to ourselves of the real reason why. It's, we want dessert, you know? But we've got to come up with all these reasons that we feel like we want to convince ourselves because our heart can deceive us. Maybe it's, you know, you look around in your home and you're very content with the size of your home and your house, but then all of a sudden you go to your friend's houses or some relatives' houses and their houses are bigger. And you start to think, maybe we should have a bigger house. And so you start to come up with all these different reasons about it, because you were content before, but now you're not. And so it's, well, you know, it would be a good investment, or it's the interest rate's really good, or, you know, we need extra space so that we can house the missionaries when they come through town, and yeah, we need all this extra room so that we can really be servants of the Lord. And, you know, we come up with all these different reasons. Again, a bigger house isn't a bad thing. It's just paying attention to what our heart does to us when it's deceiving us and manipulating us is the real reasons why we're going after things. And it's because our heart so often gets emotionally captured by certain ideas. There's this thing that I have to do, our heart convinces us of. You have to buy it right now. You know, you've got to say this certain thing, and we get emotionally attached to an idea or this prospect of doing something. And the irony is, when other people do that, and they start giving us all their reasons for why they're making a particular decision, and we're listening to them, and we can tell it's all just, you know, they're being manipulated by themselves, they're coming up with all these reasons that are just emotional and that make really no sense, logical sense at all, we see right through that. We see right through the reasoning. But when it comes to us, we're so easily deceived by our heart. Because what Jeremiah warns us is very true. And he says that the heart is deceitful above all things.
If you look, it says the heart. It's not talking about the organ in your chest. It's the Hebrew word leb, and sometimes it's translated heart. Sometimes it's mind or thinking or innermost being. Think of when it says heart, you're talking about the real you, the realest, youest you that there is. And so on the inside of who you really are, not separate, on the inside of who you are, there is deceit. Now in Hebrew, the word deceitful is akov, where Jacob's name comes from, Yaakov. So Akov doesn't mean just liar. He doesn't walk around telling tales to see if anybody can figure out that they're not true. He doesn't come up and say, hey, nice pants. This isn't what he does. Jacob, if you read the story of Jacob, lives by his name insofar as that he does things and says whatever he needs to and does whatever he needs to further his own story. When he's in a corner, he'll say this. He's in a jam, he'll do this. Whatever he needs to do to protect himself and provide for himself the story that he really, really wants in that moment. Jacob does whatever. This is what Jonathan was talking about. It's not just lies. It's a lot of truth mixed with a lot of untruth, manipulated in such a way so as to be beneficial. And your heart doesn't just go around telling tales. Your heart takes things and turns them for your own benefit. Turns this. Manipulates this, takes truths and perverts it just a little bit so as to benefit you. On your innermost being, you have not something else lying to you. Your heart lies for you. That's why when you're in the middle of a decisive moment, and maybe it's an impulse or it's an ongoing list of decisions that lead to this ultimate decision, you're not sitting there listening to a voice going, you're lying, but yeah, that's I like it. It's inside of you, and it makes sense. I was just talking to a couple about a week ago, who they had all of these relational things in place so that they could honor each other. They're really trying to paint a great story with their relationship. And she said that this one moment happens, and this one weekend where suddenly her mind was full of other ideas and her emotions and her heart was beating and one thing led to another. And then that weekend, everything changed. And then Monday she looked back and went, what the heck happened? Who was that? But what she recognized is that her heart lied for her. Her heart told her things that, man, that wasn't true. But it was true in the moment. And that's what the prophet Jeremiah is saying, that the heart is deceitful, that it wants to lie for you. But we get so obsessed in our psychological culture for the inner child. Pay attention to your inner child. Great. But I'm convinced that the inner parent is the way, way bigger force. That inside of you, there's a mommy or a daddy holding you, going, shh, 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 I will defend you. I will do whatever you need to keep you comfy and safe and warm. And it's you. And it's you holding you. I know that's how my brain works. That's a great Pink Floyd album cover if you're, you know. But it's the inner parent saying, I'm going to make sure nothing harmful or uncomfortable ever affects you relationally, emotionally, vocationally, monetarily, all of those things. Because your heart lies for you. In the moment, it's not a lie. This is what's right. And so then he says, and it's desperately sick. The word translated desperately sick in Hebrew, if you chase it around in the Old Testament, it's translated weak, incurably, without strength. And so what it doesn't say is you're desperately evil. I've heard that in a lot of sermons, but that's not what the Bible says right there. That you're on the inside of you is just rotten, good for nothing, evil. No, it's sickness. Jesus said that I've come to heal the sick. And so, how many good decisions do you make when you're sick? Not very many. And don't think of it as just simply disease. Think of it as weak, as deficient. So when a 13-year-old walks up to a spillway and says, what could be wrong? That's a desperate sickness. It's a desperate deficiency. I didn't have the experience or a father's heart to really be able to make a good decision right there. I just went with my gut. I just followed my heart. But I wasn't ready to be followed. My gut wasn't ready. I was immature. I was immature. That desperately sick could mean deficient in such a way that you're twisted up. You have a view of reality that was handed to you by your parents or school, whatever it was. And you see things in a way that don't really match reality. It's real for you, but your perception is twisted. It's deficient. It can mean that your heart is broken. Pain. You don't walk around crying all the time, but you get pain. You took some hits in your life. You get pain. And from a survivalist heart, from a wounded, self-protecting heart, you make decisions. So we tell people all the time, hey, just go with your gut. You know, hey, facing a big decision, I get a card in the mail. Just follow your heart. Go with your gut. Aw. Jeremiah would go, you're an idiot. Don't do that. Not unless your heart has been trained in the ways of wisdom. The heart is deceitful. It lies for you and is desperately sick. Who can understand it? Yeah, just go with your gut. No. You don't make good decisions when you're sick. Ladies, when you're in the middle of labor, is it time to make decisions about your child's education? Can it wait? I can't think right now. Pain. Distraction. Guys, when you got 104 temperature, really it's a 99 point something, but it feels, you know. You got the 104 temperature. Is it time to make lasting decisions vocationally? No, I can't think about anything else other than right now. I'm sick. Jeremiah says, well, that's always running in the background. There's always deficiency. We bring this sick, uneducated, immature heart and say, is it right or is it wrong? But the question for today and the question for our faith going forward isn't, is it right or wrong? It's recognizing what Jeremiah is saying about my innermost being. Is it wise? Is it wise? That's why Proverbs 28 says this. Whoever trusts in his own leb, see it's mind there, it's heart, simply mind, heart, thinking. Whoever goes with his gut is a what? Now that, what, a clown? No, in the first century, you call somebody a fool, you've just said a huge cuss word. This is a heavy word. You call me a fool? Whoever trusts and just goes with his gut, just whatever I feel, whatever makes me happy. It's not wrong, so it must be right. Whoever does that is a fool, but he who walks and lives in the ways of wisdom will be delivered, saved, rescued, will escape. Saved, rescued, delivered, escape what? You tell me. Look back at what you regret. Do you look at it in hindsight and go, man, I was evil? Maybe, but not most of the time, you know what you say. He's an idiot. if I only knew then, it was stupid. Man, you look back on your biggest regrets and it's foolishness, not evil. You want to be delivered from that kind of story from this moment forward. Begin walking outside of a binary, is it good, is it bad, and begin living in the ways of wisdom.
So yeah, so for us, that begins with having the courage to ask this question. Yeah, is it wise? Is it the wise choice to make? That if we would add that filter onto whatever decision that we're facing, that we would find ourselves being rescued and delivered from a lot of future pain, a lot of future regret, a lot of future heartache. But in asking that question, it begs another question to really start to tease out what wisdom is. How do we start to determine what's wise and what isn't wise? Well, the dictionary defines wisdom as the best use of knowledge or skillfully applying what we know.
My dad sent me an email this past week that said, knowledge is knowing that tomatoes are fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put them in fruit salad. Thanks, Dad.
Sage Doherty.
That's right.
Yes.
Now, don't play in the spillway. Know what to do with the tomato. It's my legacy. I'm kidding.
No, but yeah, it's exactly right. It's saying, what do we do with what we know? And how do we skillfully apply it? But to get there, you know, it requires asking some different types of questions. Questions also like, okay, based on what I know about God's heart, based on what I know about God's character, based on what I know about the life that God is inviting me into, what's the wise choice to make here? Because you see, wisdom has lots of other things that dance with it. For example, that we'd ask a question, how does this affect the other people around me? Because you don't separate the decision that I'm making from other people and from people that I care about and from other people that I don't even know, that you can't separate love and compassion from wisdom, that they all dance together. And so how does this decision, how does this choice affect the other people around me? They would ask questions like, based on what I want the future to look like, based on what I hope my situation can look like in the future and what I want to see that be, what's the wise decision to make in this moment? They would ask questions like, based on my current situation, based on my circumstances, right now, because it can be different for different people. Doesn't mean it's, you know, wisdom isn't this binary good or bad, right or wrong. It's always clear cut. But based on my particular circumstances, my situation, what's the wise choice to make? Based on where we're at financially, what's the wise decision for us to make? Doesn't mean that someone else can be in a different position financially. It's what about for us? Or based on where I'm at emotionally, what's the wise decision for me to make? So I look back on my past, when I look back on the regrets that I've made, when I look back on the pain and heartache that some of my decisions and repeated decisions has caused and the foolishness it has led to, based on my own experiences, what's the wise decision for me to make? When I look at other people's decisions, when I look at other people's pain and hurt and regret and their experiences, what's the wise decision to make? See, many times I think we leave that question out because we get kind of headstrong and we say, you know what? I'm just going to have to learn it for myself. I'm just going to have to experience it for myself. And so I'll ignore all sorts of wisdom that's out there and all sorts of pain and regret that other people have suffered and say, well, I'm just going to have to learn this lesson on my own. But you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, I've sat down, I've talked to so many people over the years, and yeah, I've never sat down with an addict on my couch who says, you know what? I am so glad I took that first hit. You know, I'm so glad I took that second one and just, you know, kept going. I'm really, really thankful for that. I've never known someone who says, you know what? I'm so glad I looked at that thing that first time. I'm so glad that I looked a second time. I'm so glad that I started lying to my spouse. I'm so glad I kind of built up all these things. You know, I've never talked to an addict who went into whatever it was that they ended up getting addicted to that thought to themselves, you know what? I can't handle this. Everyone thought that they could handle it. Everybody thought that they could handle it. No, I sit down with people on my couch and they find themselves in debt, just head over heels in debt, just this monster debt that hangs like this ominous dark cloud over their life. And it suffocates them. It tells them what they can say yes to, what they can say no to, decisions that they can make and can't make. It puts this incredible strain and stress on their relationships and sometimes destroys relationships. And I've never sat down with any of them that says, you know what, I'm really glad I purchased all those things I couldn't afford. No one ever says that, ever. And so that we would have the wisdom to look around at repeated patterns of behavior of people who live with pain and regret and not get in our pride or in our arrogance that think, I have to learn for myself. My story is going to be different than the hundreds and thousands of people who have all lived before me and who have kept doing the same things and led to the same regret. I'm going to be different, or I have to learn for myself, rather than just simply asking, you know what? Now I'm going to learn from their experience. I'm going to ask, based on their experience, what's the wise thing to do? It's the wise choice to make. You see, asking the wisdom question creates a new standard for us. And it's a standard that we all want. I mean, all of us want to be wise. I mean, God himself embodies wisdom. And so God, one of the ways he invites us into life through trusting him is to say, we'd ask this question. What's wise? And it creates this new standard rather than this binary standard that we often use, where we only tend to ask questions, is it good or is it bad? Is it right or is it wrong? Is it legal or is it illegal? Is it, you know, is there a verse in the Bible to support it, or is there not a verse in the Bible to support it? We want to put it in these different camps. But what we do many times with binary decisions like good or bad, we find ourselves trying to walk right up to the line. How close do I get to the edge and still be considered in the right category or the good category without crossing over? But you see, wisdom asks a whole different set of questions, and wisdom calls us to a whole new type of standard of living, where the standard is no longer, well, you know what, if the bank will loan me the money, then it must be okay. Or as long as I don't think I'm going to get caught, it must be okay. That's no longer the standard. Or it's no longer the standard, well, if she's okay with going that far, then it must be okay. But that we would be the kind of people who would be courageous enough to stop and to pause and to ask the question, is this the wise thing to do? Is this the wise choice to make? And asking that question prevents so much disaster. It prevents so much future regret. Because what it does is it starts to peel back the layers of deception that we've allowed our heart so often to convince us of.
Let me give a specific example. And there's tons of examples. And then there's all these ways we can speak about it generally. But I want to talk about a very specific way that this plays out. And Jonathan and I were talking about this about a week ago, and talking about it in the context of this message specifically, and then knowing as I was going to talk about it, I recognized that it's one of those hot button kinds of issues, at least in faith, where there in this room will be people on this side of it and people on this side of it. And what I want you to know is I am preparing right now to annoy people on both sides. It's kind of exciting for me. And just if you're new here, we annoy each other. Family does that. You're still part of the family, all right? So that's what we do. But I want to talk about this issue very specifically because I think it radiates outward. I don't think it's a central issue, but it radiates outwards. And so maybe there's some principles you can take and apply to other areas of your life. So that'll be your homework, to take this specific thing and then let it radiate outward into other areas. And so now that I've built it up, I want you to know that it's about watching SpongeBob. I think, no, it's not that. It's not. That's clearly evil. I don't even need to go there. So. No, it's about alcohol. And, ooh, quiet now. Yeah. Please talk about SpongeBob. I want to deal with this in hopefully just the right way. I don't drink. The reason I don't drink in the beginning, the very beginning of my faith walk, was very black and white. It's bad. It's evil. And then I would, here's all the reasons that it's bad. And so if you drink, you're bad. You are in the wrong. It was very black and white for the first couple of years of my faith. It was just, that's just how it is. So if you want to be not bad, come over to where I live, into good land where we don't drink. I mean, it's just that simple. My problem is, as I'm reading through the scriptures, reading original languages, talking to people that are very, very faithful people who drink alcohol. What? How can, what? And then, Jesus is my standard, and his first miracle was not turning water into 7-Up. What do I do with this? And so I continued to not drink. I spent that season early on, and the binary right and wrong, black and white kind of thing. But not long after, I realized, no. The reason I, Steve Dougherty, don't drink is a wisdom issue. If you look at my family going backward historically, it's mostly comprised of health and beauty and all those good things. But peppered in are stories where alcohol has destroyed, killed, ruined. So that's not the whole story, but that is in the story. And so it doesn't take many of those stories peppered in to make you go, hey, wait a minute, now I have a decision to make. So you can come at it and say, it's bad or it's good. But what I was facing is people of deep faith that have inspired me over the years, that have led me. They drink alcohol. See, what I realized, it's a wisdom issue. And regardless of what side of what camp you choose, a lot of people go, well, you're being relativistic. You're saying what's good for them isn't. Wisdom lives in that world a little bit. I mean, it takes some thinking. Black and white rules, that's easy. You don't have to think about it. Bad, good, bad. It's just like a light that goes on and off. You don't even have to think. You don't have to be transformed. You just follow the rule. Wisdom forces you to think. It forces you to recognize, and for me personally, it's a wisdom issue. I have a choice to make, and I recognize when I look at my own familial history and the respected friends of my family going through the ages, it did some damage. It wouldn't be wise for me to step into that part of the river. Just wouldn't be. I don't do that. Now, when you look at this issue specifically with alcohol, you find that there are some laws, some right and wrongs associated with it. If you are not 21 and you're drinking, you're breaking the law. If you take Jesus seriously and you break that law, you are speaking and acting against your faith. Because the Bible's very clear. Every rule you can follow in your particular part of the world, your tribe, your nation, unless it goes against the character of God, you should follow it. We are to be citizens that follow the law every chance that we get. So if you drink and you're under 21, you're not only breaking the law, but you're breaking kingdom law, which I would say supersedes it. If you drink and drive, you're breaking the law. It's against the law to do that. Now, let's change the laws. Let's make the drinking age 15, God help us. And let's say you can drink and drive. What we're going to do is that the far right lane is extra wide, call it the red zone, the red lane. It's double wide, it's got guardrails, and you get a helmet. So now it's legal. You can drink in the middle of your teenage years, and you can drink and drive. How many of you have the sneaking suspicion that it's still something's still wrong? It's wisdom. It's not a right or wrong issue. That's a wisdom issue. That wouldn't be smart. We're not going to do that. Yeah, but it's legal. And see, what a lot of us do is what Jonathan was saying. How far all the way over to the side of don't can we get before crossing over? How much is too much? How little is too little? I mean, we're talking about alcohol. We're talking about everything. What's the least amount of this or the most I can participate in without hacking off God? That's not wisdom. That's 13-year-olds saying, how close can I get to this thing without breaking the rule? Oh, I broke the rule and it didn't cost me. I'm going to change the rule. That's not wisdom. That's not wisdom. Now, the Bible very clearly says, don't get drunk. Don't get drunk. It's disrespectful to God. It's disrespectful to others, to yourself. You're changing the way that you make decisions and all that stuff, right? It's not, hey, if you've done this, this isn't a condemnation thing. It's the unforgivable sin. No, it's not that. It says, don't do it. You're changing something about yourself, and you don't want to do that. And so don't do that. Now, some people say, well, how do you know how much to drink before you cross that line? If you don't know, maybe you're not ready. Well, is it right or wrong? Wrong question. You understand? How far is too far? How little? Maybe you're not ready. See, some people will hear this and go, wait. Did the pastor just say it's okay to drink? Ooh, maybe not for you. You understand the difference? Right and wrong is a great thing. Good, bad, okay, not okay, is a great thing to have until wisdom. Because people, generally speaking, lack wisdom inherently. You have to have laws. You have to have rules. God gave it, the nations gave it. Those are important, and you follow them. But they're in place and to be of the highest order until wisdom kicks in. And then you're, oh yeah, I don't need the rule. Now I understand kingdom wisdom that's connected to love and compassion and all those things. Like he was saying, it's an entirely different way of living. And it's an entirely different way of making decisions. And it's available to us. See, a lot of us, we've got stuff that we regret. And you think, well, if I look at my track record, that's obviously not me. No, no, no. It starts the minute you start it. At any moment, you can step in and say, you know what? From now on, I'm not going to ask simple binary questions about, is it okay? Is it not okay? There's nothing against it. I'll do it. I feel like from this moment forward, we're invited to make decisions along the lines of asking the question, is this wise? I don't want to live the way that I used to. I want to live a different kind of life. It doesn't matter where we come from. You get to go forward at a different way, the ways of wisdom.
Yeah, and that question, is it wise? Again, to his point, which, you know, it's great, but it doesn't always, it comes down in all sorts of different layers in our life, mm-hmm. not just in these huge moral dilemmas, mm-hmm. maybe, or things that, you know, this camp wants to fight about this camp, and, you know, different people in this binary, right or wrong, good or bad. But sometimes just in those day-to-day decisions that we have to make, you know, one of those, for me, and we've talked about this in here before, but I find myself talking about it with a lot of couples, a lot of married couples that sit down on my couch and in my office. And I know this sounds weird, and I know it sounds very countercultural, and I know it sounds, wow, that just seems like that's out there. But, you know, I'll sit down and I'll talk to them. And one of those things is I'm always cautioning people against is, hey, if you're married and on a business lunch, you know, or date, you're going out and eating with a member of the opposite sex who's not your spouse, or you're traveling in a car alone with a member of the opposite sex who's not your spouse, then I'm going to caution you that's an unwise decision. And people kick back and they're like, oh, well, are you telling me it's wrong? And I'm like, no, I'm not saying it's not wrong to do that. We're not putting it in the right or wrong camp. I'm just saying it's unwise. And they're like, well, but my spouse is okay with it. And sometimes I'll have, you know, couples before they get married, and they're talking about this happened just a couple months ago, and they're, you know, talking about getting married, and each of them regularly travel, you know, with members of the opposite sex on business trips, alone, just the two of them, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm not telling you it's wrong. I'm telling you it's unwise, but my spouse is okay with it. You know, this person I'm going to marry, they're okay with me doing that. And look, she's okay, I'm okay, it's all right. And I'm like, listen, that's not the standard. And that shouldn't be the standard. What I'm trying to challenge you to ask is it wise that when you look around at other experiences, when I've sat down and listened to my couch of these couples tell me about a lot of pain and heartache that's been caused by stuff that they thought early on, oh yeah, this isn't that big of a deal. Man, caused a lot of hurt. And you see, asking the question, is it wise? In this particular context, what it's doing is it's honoring your spouse. It's not a trust issue of, well, does my spouse trust me or not? This is a way that I can honor them. This is a way I can protect our marriage. This is the way I protect our relationship, that I don't allow, you know, the enemy to get a wedge in us. See, many times what wisdom does is wisdom plans not to get yourself into a situation where you find yourself driven by emotion and impulse. That wisdom plans in advance so that you don't have to be forced to, what do I make this decision in this moment when I'm already here? It's wisdom plans in advance, and how do I protect that? And again, I know that's not convenient, and I know it's not hard. I mean, I know that it is hard, but again, it's asking, is it wise? You know, but again, when you talk about different people in different situations and just day-to-day life, maybe you're a guy and you travel a lot for work and you're gone, you know, all during the week, and you come home on the weekend, and maybe your wife stays at home and you've got toddlers or they're kind of at a young age. And so, but you come home, one of the things that really fills your tank is playing golf. And so, you know, you're like, man, I just want to go play golf all day on Saturday and Sunday afternoon. And in your particular situation, in your particular circumstances, you have to ask the question, is that wise? Is that when I come home after my wife's been at home with the kids all week long, is it wise for me to just say, hey, I'm going to check out weekend after weekend after weekend? Now, does that mean golf's a bad thing? No, not at all. Golf can be great, and it can fill your tank up, and yeah, mm-hmm. have a lot of fun with that.
No.
Well, not, yeah.
Not when you're bad at it.
Well, that's true.
Drains the tank.
Can be a stress reliever. Yeah. So, but it's just asking the question, in my particular situation, in these circumstances, at this stage of life, is it wise? You see, asking the wisdom question, no matter what it is, it creates a whole new standard for us, rather than trying to always live in this binary camp of, is it only good or bad? Is it only right or wrong? I want to close with this. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. Paul, and later on in the scriptures, this New Testament writer, he says, be very careful then how you live. Now, that word careful isn't saying, you know, how do you tiptoe around and act, you know, really nervous and scared and real cautiously around life. The heart of that word in the Greek there is that you need to just pay really close attention. You need to see the world accurately. You need to see the whole truth and the whole context of a situation and pay attention. Don't let yourself get deceived. Don't let yourself get blinded just by all sorts of different emotions and things that are going on. It says, be very careful. Be very aware. See accurately. Be very careful how you live. Not as unwise, but as wise. And so here's what I'd hope for us. I hope that we would be the kind of people who would have the courage to ask the question, is this the wise thing to do? When you look around at your decisions right now, maybe that you're facing, maybe that you're considering or pondering, maybe you find yourself in circumstances that you're in because of certain choices and decisions that you've already made, that you would have the courage to ask the question, is what I'm doing or what is what I'm thinking about doing, is it the wise thing to do? Now, if that feels threatening to you, if asking that question feels threatening, you need to pay attention to that. Because you've just uncovered a gold mine of information about yourself. Now, it doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you don't love Jesus. You're not a follower of Jesus. What it means is it should be this light on the dashboard that, wait a second, okay, my mind is more undisciplined than I thought it was. Because again, wisdom is something that we all want. We all want to live wisely and to make wise choices. And so if it seems threatening to ask the question, is this the wise thing to do? We got to pay attention to that. Where's that coming from? That we would ask, is what I'm doing now, is this the wise thing? And if it's not, why am I doing it? You know, many times the reason that we're doing it is we've got emotionally captured by things. We've gotten all caught up emotionally and we've been deceived. We've been manipulated by our hearts. Sometimes the reality is we just don't care. You know, I just don't even care what the wise thing is. You know, we find ourselves tired, exhausted, worn out, fed up, and we say, I don't even care what the wise thing is. I don't even want to ask that anymore. But again, that goes back to what Jeremiah says. The reason sometimes we find ourselves not caring is because he says the heart is deceitful above all things. And that we would be wise enough to say, hey, I need some other people to speak into this right now. Because I'm so drained emotionally, I'm so tired, I'm so exhausted, I don't even want to consider what the wise thing is. So that we'd have the courage to say, hey, would you help me wrestle through what's the wise thing to do? Because understand, this is one of the ways that God invites us into life, invites us into the life that he has for us. Wisdom is not separated from God, that God embodies wisdom, and he invites us to trust him. And he says, one of the practical ways you're going to start to get handles on this path that I'm inviting you into is to be willing and courageous enough to ask the question, is this the wise thing to do? And as we do, we'll discover that our Father's heart is indeed for us, and that over and over again, his heart is to lead us into life. Let's pray. Father, thanks for my brothers and sisters here. Thanks for their willingness to go on this journey together. And Father, may we leave here today challenged and filled with a spirit of resolve that we would ask the critically important question, is what I'm thinking about doing, is what I'm doing, is what I'm participating in, is it the wise thing? And through that, we'd let you lead us. Pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Thanks, friends. See you next week.